Welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Dellingpole. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but I can't. I can't this week, and I think you might be able to guess why. See if your guess is right in a moment. Until then, let's have a word from one of our sponsors. Sina Crisps. I used to eat loads and loads of crisps in my normie days, and then, of course, I discovered that they're all cooked in toxic seed oils, and so I pretty much gave up. The people behind Sina have come up with a brilliant idea of cooking crisps not in seed oils, but in coconut oil, so they're actually not harmful to you. And they also taste... good. Was that a good idea to eat my crisps in the middle of the advert? I'm not sure. Anyway, I just want to make something absolutely clear. Just because I'm starting to do crisp adverts doesn't mean I'm about to become the new Gary Lineker. That's a joke that will go completely over the head of non-British viewers, and I envy those who don't know who Gary Lineker is. They're organic, they are not ultra-processed food, no seed oils, and you can find them at www.sinacrisps, that's S for sugar, I-N-A, crisps.com.
Use the code James for 15% off your order.
So, again, I'm not Gary Lineker, and I envy those of you who don't know who Gary Lineker is. I'm advertising crisps, but they are good crisps. They taste good, and they're cooked in coconut oil. So check out Sina Crisps.
Use the code James, J-A-M-E-S, that's me, for 15% off your order.
Dick.
Mm.
You're the surprise guest.
Well, whoa, you're not a surprise. Boo. We're heavily in mourning, aren't we?
We are. I was thinking, is this the first James and Dick podcast that our beloved father never watched?
I think the last time I was asking our listeners and viewers to pray for our father because he was in hospital and we were going to visit him, and it was just prior to
thanks guys for not praying hard enough. where were you when we needed you?
Well, as we know, it all came good in the end. I think we've discussed this. The reason we can't quite be as cut up as you might expect us to be is because our beloved father lived a fantastic 91 years and died without any real prolonged fuss or misery or pain. And no one can say fairer than that. You really can't be too cut up about it, apart from the fact that he's no longer here.
Well, and also the fact that we're both Christians, which means that we don't think of death as the end. I mean, I do feel sorry for that. And I love all my atheist followers, whatever, but it must be a source of, not a source of comfort. If you think this is it, because actually, yeah. If this is it, then we're in trouble, really.
I do have a friend, actually, who has just died himself. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is we discussed it over a pint one time. A friend of his who came to him with only a few days to live, and he said, you're a Christian, aren't you? He said, yes. He said, well, is it too late for me? I really suddenly, you know, the whole deathbed conversion thing, yeah. He suddenly got very concerned about what there is after this. And some people simply leave it to the last minute to start thinking about these things. And of course, any good Christian will tell you it's never too late, but it's as well to give it some consideration beforehand.
So did he? Oh, hang on, let me just get rid of this. Hang on. Pops, I'm doing a podcast with your uncle. Is that all right? Is it? It wasn't urgent. Okay, that's love. Bye.
You turned it off.
Why?
No, I thought you said you'd cancel the EMF.
I thought I did as well. Oh, you know what it did?
What?
You know what happened? I turned off the, I put it on airplane mode.
Right.
But the Wi-Fi
allowed it to penetrate my defenses.
It gets you one way or another, doesn't it?
It does. Presumably, is it giving off EMF with the Wi-Fi?
I don't know these things. This is all beyond my ken.
I thought you might know, being the tech bro.
Yeah, right. That's a low bar, though, isn't it?
Yeah. So, just briefly, did the guy convert on his?
No, I think he got given words of comfort. But I mean, what do you have to do to convert at the last minute? Do you need priests on board to?
Absolutely, you've got until the last second.
And what do you have to say?
I just think you find a formula where you accept Jesus into your heart, something like that, or ask God to, I mean, the right God, not the demiurge, say, or I mean, that's not going to work, is it? You're going to be in trouble then. So I think it's that's the deal. You get until the last. So even Bill Gates, I mean, there may be Christianity experts on this who will correct me, but even Bill Gates, even the Antichrist, Peter Thiel, Antichrist candidate Peter Thiel, any of these characters, even Hillary Clinton, who even after Frazzledrip and even after, I mean, I don't know how many children she's done terrible things to, allegedly, but she'll probably come after me like she does all her other enemies. Even she has the option of
repenting and begging for forgiveness.
It's, by the way, we ought to say to people, look, this isn't going to be the Christian insanity podcast, which excludes you if you're not a Christian, and it's not going to be depressing death, oh, our dad's died, please feel sorry for us podcast. When we're kind of, even though we're really sad that he's gone, we're kind of on a high, or almost. I mean,
no, I think that's a fair description. I was feeling very buoyant at the end of our big day that we've been building up to for a month, and there have been a lot of challenges on the way. It's difficult to keep everyone happy in these things, to fulfill everyone's wishes. So, I mean, there were certain parties within the family who were strongly against a burial, for instance.
There, they wanted ashes to be scattered, which we vetoed as a pagan ceremony.
Which is, I don't think a lot of people realise how pagan the whole cremation and scattering is, or what a brutal process it goes through after you've been roasted and grinding down the bones with ball bearings to give you that powder that you can then tip over the mould.
And picking out the bits of metal from your
things, So it's when it comes down to it, the burial is natural, it's Christian, it was all rather beautiful. And the spot that we gave him, even the naysayers were won over at that little spot in Malvern Cemetery that I apparently have paid for. A beautiful view of the Malvern Hills. Rather than being scattered on them, he gets to look up at them. He gets to lift up his eyes unto the hills.
We get to visit him in one spot, rather than having to go and run over the Malvern Hills trying to find where the bits of ash ended up.
Yeah, hoping we don't inhale too much of it.
Yeah. So that was good. I found it very interesting. In fact, morbidly fascinating, one might say. This was the first ever funeral I've been to where somebody was actually lowered into the ground, and it did look like literally 6 feet under.
It's a deep hole, isn't it?
And
let me tell you, that was the shallower option that I took. You can choose to have a deeper grave so that they can add another one on top of it at a later date.
Oh.
And I said I didn't anticipate anyone else wanting to join him particularly. So I went for the shallower option, which was a 50 quid less or something like that. But it could have easily been deeper. But it does seem to be deep, doesn't it?
It does.
You're looking in, trying to see coffin, and it's
sort of,
on top of it before you can see coffin.
Only in episodes. I mean, you often see interment scenes, burial scenes on TV, and normally it's the policeman is looking for the murder suspect.
Is going to lurking behind a tree somewhere.
Yeah,
because they always return to the scene of their crime or something. Or it quite often happens in sort of conspiracy theories, and there's a sort of cemetery in Virginia somewhere where somebody, sinister people hang out and make contact with each other.
I think of the one in Omen as well. There was a big where Damien stood there looking sinister. That they've got famous burial scenes there. But yeah, you never see the cremation service on Hollywood films. Do you?
You don't. And you, Randall and Hopkirk deceased. I before the funeral, I tried looking to see whether I could find a white suit for me,
knowing that I'd be in a black one.
Yeah, it would have been a good touch. Only a certain generation would have got the joke, but it would have been quite cool, I think. Marty, or he was called Marty, wasn't he?
Was he? I don't know. It was more your thing than it ever was mine. I think I was just a little bit too young for it.
Sorry, younger listeners. This is
I think your cutoff point will probably be 1967.
Oh, okay, right, okay, fair enough. So I could not. I mean, obviously, it's sad seeing one's dad lowered into the ground for the last time. But I was just like peering down the hole, just sort of oh, that's Daddy down there. Pa.
Even more so when he arrived when we were outside the church, ready to be pallbearers, and we took the decision to go for the trolley rather than the lifting onto shoulders because of the heat of the day, the ease of. It was fine in the end, but it was walking up with a sibling on each handle, walking up that church aisle to the strains of the Dam Busters. It almost felt like we were going to release a bouncing bomb at any point.
I was smiling at that point, and I was trying. I have to say, when I saw the coffin come out of the hearse, I was thinking to myself, James, you've really got to keep it together at this point. Do not think about your dead dad being inside that coffin, because you could very easily lose it, and you've got to deliver the eulogy.
Which you were going to do off the cuff.
Well, I did.
It's not like there were any notes. For my reading, it's kind of been written down for quite some time, my reading from Revelation. It had to be, delivered fresh.
I had to do it fresh and not off a thing, off a script, because I knew it's what he wouldn't have wanted me to do. In the sense that he'd have said, you're going to do a script, aren't you, just in case. I mean, you don't want to cock this one up. And I was going, well, Pa, I know you'd worry about that, of course, but you know what I'm like. I just like winging it. And it wouldn't be me, your son, that you made this way, frankly, if I didn't sort of ignore your instructions and just go ahead. So
that was generally the theme of the day, wasn't it? How he'd made five siblings who were resolutely determined to do their thing despite any advice he might ever have given us. And yet he remained hugely proud of every single one of us. Almost because we did our own thing without taking his advice, which is exactly what he would have done. So it was a double whammy there. You know, you fulfilled his wishes by not fulfilling his wishes.
Exactly. He really hated being told what to do. He thought
he was wrong about something. I wonder where you get that. Never wrong. In 91 years, he was never knowingly wrong.
Never
about
knowingly
anything.
Wrong. Yeah, he felt that there should be one rule for the rest of the world, and another rule for Dellingpoles, and the world had to adjust itself to whatever the Dellingpoles want to do. And that's, even though we're all incredibly different, the five Dellingpole siblings, I think the two things we have in common are one. A very inappropriate, black, piss-taking sense of humour. Mm-hmm. And the other is this determination to be ourselves at no matter what personal cost. So we can get just hated by the rest of the world. We'll lose all our money. We'll whatever. Just as long as we can be totally ourselves and not make any compromises, we're happy with that.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair. But the day could not have gone any better, really, could it?
I mean, despite
the fact that that it was hot, I don't care what my detractor on Twitter earlier today, who's decided because I happened to mention in passing that it was a little bit hot out there, that I'm a complete traitor to the climate change's bollocks cause. Mm. But yes, it was a little bit on the warm side.
It was.
And we were very grateful for the wake venue, the Abbey Hotel in Malvern, having superb air conditioning. And little things like that, we suffered out there while we lowered him into the ground, but then we got rewarded with the aircon. And our show together was very well received. The venue, I could have only got 100 people in there. Now, anyone who's arranged a funeral will know it's not quite like a party. You don't invite X number of people and cater for that number, hoping they all turn up. You basically throw it open to all comers and cater for, I don't know, half of them, all of them, more than you ever knew existed. So that venue is the biggest I could get, and it catered for 100. And I reckon we had exactly 100 people in there, because every seat was taken. The food was eaten with gusto, and it was just, it was from him upstairs. You know,
I think
he was helping with proceedings.
God was definitely ordering things very, very generously for us. I mean, I said a few prayers beforehand, but look, I mean, not everyone.
Well, there would have been other people praying for us, which I realized was going to have had played an important factor in it. The fact that so many people were wishing us well and praying for a good day for us, that, you know, we had it. So let's not ignore the fact that these prayers would have certainly been answered that day.
Well, it's why we do this thing, because it works, because it's real. You know, God is actually there, and he is looking out for you if you try and do the right thing and be a godly person. I'm sure of it. I spent 3 weeks agonizing over, I read so many versions of the speech in the eulogy in my head, most of which I discarded, because it was just, actually 5 minutes before the speech. What I realized is, James, you've got to cut to the chase. No throat clearing. I mean, maybe you can mention the weather or something, but you've got to get straight in there. People haven't got time to hang about. You can't spend the whole service paying tribute to your dad waffling. You've got to get to the essence. So for anyone making any important speech, I'm writing a piece about this at the moment. The thing you've got to remember is, what are you going to say in your speech? You're going to say the thing that has to be said. Everything else is extraneous. The jokes will come, the asides will come, but you've got to say the thing that needs to be said. That is your priority, and nothing else.
And so, what for you was the crux of it? What was the thing that had to be said?
Well, I was rather hoping it came across in my eulogy.
Yeah, but if you were to distill it down to one thing for our audience here,
that. My dad, I asked my dad, our dad, once, when was he happiest? And he said, well, round about when you were born. And it was no slur on the children that followed. What he meant was that was the point where he realized his purpose in life. And his purpose in life was to breed Dellingpoles and create an empire of Dellingpoles. I mean, it was quite a small empire. It's not like the Roman Empire or the British Empire or, I don't know, even the Latvian Empire, but it was what he wanted and what he was very, very good at. And he spent the rest of his life really devoting himself to his children.
And then later his grandchildren.
Later his grandchildren. Mm. And he was not, as I said, I think, he wasn't so good at laying up for himself treasures on earth. He spunked it all on family holidays and his business didn't do as well as he might have hoped, and he had all sorts of travails, but he stuck to his guns. What he was really good at was being a good dad, and people love, I mean, not just a good dad, because everyone who met him thought, you're great, because he was interesting and interested. Mm-hmm. And he had massive range of hobbies and interests, ranging from guppy breeding to collecting reptiles and amphibians to around the world, walking and so on and on it went. He was a very interesting person, and he loved being with people, and people were drawn to, I mean, to get 100 people coming to your funeral on a really
It was somewhat more in the church. I think someone counted at least 130. So a lot of people would have just been paying tribute in the church, and then on such a hot day deciding they weren't close enough family to go up to the, but you know, that's midday on the hottest day of the year in Malvern. So I think we did really, really well on getting that number in. And if any of the audience congregation are listening now, thank you, because you know, it's no small ask to come along and give away your day like that to pay your respects to our father. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I can't think of that. There are many 91-year-olds outside ones being given the state funeral, say, who can pull that kind of crowd.
And such a diverse crowd as well. There were a lot of the tinfoil hat brigade, you know, my mates essentially, who enjoyed his company in Malvern over the stand in the park lot, for instance, who he made his own. I never really did stand in the park. I had Third Wednesday going, but he adopted and was adopted by the Malvern stand in the park group, who were quite a strong group. And he continued that, you know, right up until the last month of his life. And he was with them every Sunday, and you know, they'd carried on meeting long after the COVID nonsense. And they enjoyed his company, and he was just another one of them. And they kind of adopted him as the grandpa of the group. We'd all be walking together on the hills regularly. Something, as I showed in our slideshow, that he was doing right up until a month before he died. So this really was not just a sort of gradual decline. This was a still hill walking a month before he died,
You say the congregation was diverse, Dick. I'm not sure that's strictly true. I can't say it was abundant with ethnic hues.
Have you met Malvern? It's exactly
people,
that.
People, I think, did. I mean, by people, I mean the people watching this. You really should have been the James and Dick show that we did.
The special,
the James and Dick special the death special was. If only we'd recorded it.
Well, you did suddenly burst out with those words halfway through your sentence. I think you suddenly went, "Is anyone recording this? Why isn't anyone recording this?"
But it was very popular. I mean, how long did we go on for?
I don't know, because it just had to take the time that it took, but it didn't feel like it overran in any way. Clearly, I wasn't in the audience, but also bear in mind, no one wanted to leave that room because the heat hit you like a wall the moment you left that room. And you thought, oh, you know what? I think I'll go back and listen to those two for a bit longer.
Yeah,
and
you're
maybe
right.
Have some cake.
That was that was totally a captive audience.
And there was a bar selling cold beers as well. I mean, we gave them nice sandwiches and tea and cake and coffee and cream tea. That was all part of the deal I paid for, and with his money, by the way.
Was it expensive? I haven't
yeah, about $2,000 that whole thing. So
the wait was $2,000.
The wake's a bit higher of the room and the food, $2,000, which I think is great. It's fine.
And how much does the funeral
got the that I think has been totted up. I think it's close to $5,000.
Right. So $10,000 all in?
Not even that high.
That's very good value, I would say, for
I think it's such big business in the States that you can easily spunk away that much and much more, and people almost go into debt over these things. And I think, well, I had a friendly funeral directors who I'd used before for a friend, and I kind of knew what to do. I'd had that as a dry run, so I know that you don't want to be distracted by teak coffins and solid brass handles and things like that, because ultimately it doesn't matter.
I was reassured when I reached the handle that it was plastic,
just nicely veneered.
The nice touch, Dick, was when that? You told me just as they got the coffin out of the hearse, you said to me that Georgia, was it called Georgia?
Georgia. Our funeral director.
I wrote this, quite moving, but not mawkish tribute to our dad in The Spectator. Cause he was amazing. And he deserved it. And he used to love reading The Spectator. And I especially when it's about his family or about himself. And he didn't have time to read. Well, obviously you couldn't.
The last paragraph of your little article was one more thing. He really enjoyed reading about himself in The Spectator. And the sad thing is he'll never get to read this one. Now, Georgia read this because I photocopied this thing and gave one to Gary the Vicar, another to Georgia, just so they knew who they were handling. I thought it was a good one-page, TLDR type thing. If you want to know about our dad in a nutshell, read this. So the Vicar read it and loved it. Georgia read it and was very moved. And she phoned me on the last day, the morning of the funeral, and said, Richard, I don't know if you think this is me overstepping the mark a bit, but I read that piece and it was really moving. And the last bit nearly brought me to tears that he wouldn't get to read the article. I was going to ask, tell me if you think this is a bad idea, but I was going to put a copy of it in the coffin. And I nearly burst into tears. I thought, that is so sweet. Because she said, and then he can read it. And obviously it's a fantasy that he'll roll over, find a torch.
He won't,
and,
there's no light down there.
But we all knew what she meant. And so I said, please do that. That will be lovely. And I chose the moment that we were about to, he was being wheeled into the bit in front of the church, ready for us to wheel him in. And that's when I chose to tell you all, and I could barely get the words out, that inside that coffin, along with our father, is a little piece by you.
I did not want to be the grieving son that cracks up halfway through the eulogy. So I did spend the service in a slightly detached state. It felt more like a dream. I wasn't going to engage too much.
People, I can't really engage. I'm trying to keep it together for, quite understandable. And you wasn't being rude. You had a job to do, and you had to, it's a bit like being a rock star. You don't really want to do an interview with Kerrang.
No.
A minute before you go on.
No.
You're kind of in the zone.
Yeah. Not that it's. I mean, it is completely understandable that people should crack up and everyone's sort of moved by it and stuff. But I think that if you can avoid it, it's better, because really, what you want, the mood you want in a funeral, really is a sort of he had a great life and we love him, and here we are celebrating it, and life goes on and he lives on in us. That's kind of the vibe you want to go for, rather than the day thou gavest, Lord, is ended, which is a lovely moving hymn, but you don't want the depressing ones. You want, well,
I
we chose
coming into the Dam Busters March was kind of a statement of intent, wasn't it? It was like, because you know how people forget how jaunty that the start of that. Can you imagine that being played on a church organ as we're coming down? People were probably going, "What? We come to the right place."
And then they remember when he goes.
And of course, there's pictures of him in the order of service in his RAF uniform.
Yeah.
And then they're going, "All right, yeah, that kind of makes sense." And I think it put people at their ease and also made them realize this wasn't going to be a mawkish event. We weren't going to linger on the morbid side of things too much.
No, so, you want people feeling warm and laughing. You want to get the laughs in. I tell you the bit that I think for both of us, actually, the bit that really choked us up was when you did so much, by the way, Dick. I mean, you did all the heavy lifting. I just did that because I'm so rubbish at organizing. I'm only interested in things I'm interested in, as you know. And so I did the order of service and the eulogy, and that was it. And you did all everything else. You organized the funeral, you got the death certificates. I mean, he'd still be above ground now if it hadn't been for you. But yes, you also arranged.
Starting to smell.
Yes, quite.
Of that fish.
I was glad that there wasn't a smell coming from the coffin.
It would have been unbearable, but you know, they have them properly frozen right up until.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Phew. Yes. So the Dick and James show, death special, Malcolm Delingpole tribute special. We try to remember what music he used to play us when we were kids, and he wasn't particularly musical, but he had but there was some stuff that he chanced upon by accident where he became accidentally incredibly cool, didn't he?
It's like when you go into back then, when you went in to buy new hi-fi, there would be a tune du jour that was going to show off your new hi-fi to its best effect. And I think that's how the Kraftwerk thing was introduced to him. Something that is going to be using the stereo, so that beginning bit of Autobahn where it goes. So it's fading from one side of the speakers to the other. That would be a great thing to show. Oh, it's got stereo. Electronic music with stereo and German voices singing in German. It doesn't get any more technical than that. So that, I think, is how he would have been sold. You must get this 1974 album by an unknown band called Kraftwerk.
Yeah,
I know it was all about cars, so you know they were pushing at an open door with Parr. It had languages, it had exotic foreign countries, albeit Germany, and something a bit different and new that he could play on his 8-track in his Jag. And that's how we got it under our skin. Long journeys down to Devon on the M5 as it was being built. Now, what were the other three I had?
We'll come on to those in a moment.
Just finishing off on Kraftwerk.
Kraftwerk. Lots of people like to claim that they were there when punk was born, but we were there when techno was born.
We were party to it.
We were way ahead of the game. Loads of people sort of realize they like Kraftwerk after the event, but we were actually listening to it when it came out, when it was really obscure.
Yeah, and which made us completely prepared for when the rave culture hit. We were pretty much, we can handle this.
Yeah,
we did Kraftwerk exactly. In 74.
so yeah, that was good. And you dug out three other tracks which were so redolent of our youth. And the spooky thing was, I had not heard these tracks since probably about 1980.
Yep. So it really was the music that got both you and me. When I was doing a little bit of a run through before the event, trying to make to test that the music system was working on the speakers in the venue, I was with Helen, our sister, and just playing through the tracks. And she was, "Oh no, play this one a bit longer." So the three we played were John Denver, Matthew, and it's a very sentimental song about an uncle who was his same age, whose farmhouse and family were wiped out by a twister. Twister came and stripped them clean. And Matthew went to live with them, and he came to join the family, and he came to work the land. He something, 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 and he came to be my friend. And yeah.
Love was just a windy Kansas wheat field, and blue was just a Kansas summer sky.
Mm.
We could relate to that,
stick with
we?
You. Of course. Our Kansas summer skies. Yeah, sure. So there was that for the John Denver. For Neil Diamond, Red Rubber Ball, which you had on as your little tribute when you stuck something up on your Telegram group, which is something I hadn't heard since back then. And that even that has words that seemed so appropriate. Yeah, it's gonna be all right. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball. It just sort of seemed, well, yeah, the worst is over now. So there was that. And then the most obscure of all, how our father got into Vietnam War protest singers, Tom Paxton. I don't know.
No.
But Tom Paxton was something that was played regularly on our stereo on holiday, especially the song Jimmy Newman, which is, it presumably was Vietnam rather than Korean War.
I think it was. We really should look it up. Yeah. So
it's two soldiers in the field hospital. And one is talking to the other, who simply won't wake up the next morning because, you know, wake up, Jimmy Newman, get up, Jimmy Newman, because they're about to ship us back home. So it's all good now. It's all over. You know, you'll get your Purple Heart, and you've got to see what's going on out there. Come on, get up, Jimmy Newman. And you ultimately realize that Jimmy hasn't made it through the night. And that had quite an effect on us as kids. It was probably what set us up for a life of Vietnam films.
I said you sleep hard, but they're shaking their heads.
Mm.
Get it? Get up, Jimmy Newman. You're missing the plane. And why do you lie there still sleeping?
The night nurse is gone and the sexy one's here. And she tells us such beautiful lies. Her uniform's tight on her marvelous rear. And you've only to open your eyes.
Yeah.
So as impressionable young boys, that was quite risque, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know whether it wasn't quite innocent to me in that respect. I mean, I obviously one didn't forget her marvelous rear, but I remember being more puzzled. I remember asking Father, how old would it have been about this time? 10?
Single digits, I would have thought.
I said to him, What are the beautiful lies that she would be telling these beautiful lies? Would it be about, oh, you haven't been hideously burned, or oh, I love you, or you're handsome?
Oh, we'll definitely go out for a drink sometime. Yeah. But that's what I would have thought. But you had the curiosity to go, well, what exactly was it she was saying? And you're kind of not supposed to ask those questions, but only a child would.
Yeah. Well, you see, this was the other, I tried to capture in my speech, but the quality that Father had, and I think we've got, you and I have certainly got it. We are endlessly curious about things, and we have a sort of boyish curiosity. But Father never stopped asking questions. And look at this thing that I do. It's all about asking questions and just trying to find out, well, what's going on?
And what is it we're putting on his gravestone?
Well, his one of his many catchphrases, but this is probably the most common, which was, What else do you know? So you talk to him. You talk to him for about half an hour, and you'd exhaust most of the conversation.
The classic would be a drive home from school. We're going home from boarding school for the weekend. I'm in the back.
Yeah.
You are normally got to. We always fought for who went into the front. Any family will be familiar with that old fight.
But I was the eldest son, so I deserved
oldest son.
It.
So you got to be in the front, and he'd talk. As far as I was concerned, quite grown-up conversation with you, and I was normally quite grateful that I didn't have to do that. But yeah, so the conversation would go along. Then after you'd said everything that had to be done, there'd be a long pause, and then he'd go, "What else do you know?" And he wanted to know more. He if you knew something, he wanted to know it too. And he kept that, whether it was joining U3A, which for those of you who don't know, is kind of like a retired academics club for a kind of university for old people, an unofficial, a lecture group. They take it in turns to deliver lectures to each other on the thing that they've spent their life learning about and knowing. So a lot of retired army officers will be giving talks on things like gun barrel manufacture and things like that, little very niche things. And he himself was giving talks on things like the Silk Road, the Siege of Constantinople, various aspects of ancient Greece. Whatever he would jump on, he'd jump onto it with great gusto. He'd have to go there. He'd run trips where he'd take other members of the U3A there, you know, up to 30 people on coach trips to far-flung parts of Greece. So not content with giving a lecture on them, he'd have to do the fully immersive experience. You know, he got interested in the Book of Revelation, so it wasn't enough to just learn about it. He had to go to Patmos, was it, where the cave where John wrote Revelation, actually turning up 5 minutes after it closed. To his eternal regret, he was dithering and he missed the last chance to get in there to see the cave.
Oh, he's never going to get, but he presumably gets to talk to St. John.
Well, he's
himself.
Probably the first thing he did was talk to St. John and saying, "So, I never got to see your cave. Ah, well, let me show you."
No one gave him the memo that your life stops when you retire. He just carried on living it like you do when you're younger.
From the age of 60, he probably lived as full a life as a lot of people do in their entire lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, completely new circle of friends, new girlfriends, new social friends, new hobbies. And his lack of...
Bear with us. It's got to be done. Another book plug from James.
Global warming is a massive con. There is no evidence whatsoever that man-made climate change is a problem, that it's going to kill us, that we need to amend our lifestyle in order to deal with it. It's a non-existent problem. But how do you explain this stuff to your normie friends? Well, I've just brought out the revised edition, my 2012 classic book, Watermelons, which captures the story of how some really nasty people decided to invent the global warming scare in order to fleece you, to take away your freedoms, to take away your land. It's a shocking story. I wrote it, as I say, in 2011, actually, the first edition came out. And it's a snapshot of a particular era, the era when the people behind the climate change scam got caught red-handed, tinkering with the data, torturing till it screamed, in a scandal that I helped christen ClimateGate. So I give you the background to the skullduggery that went on in these seats of learning where these supposed experts were informing us, we've got to act now. I rumbled their scam. I then asked the question, okay, if it is a scam, who's doing this? And why? It's a good story. I've kept the original book pretty much as is, but I've written two new chapters, one at the beginning and one at the end, explaining how it's even worse than we thought. I think it still stands up. I think it's a good read. I'm biased, but I'd recommend it. You can buy it from jamesdellingpole.co.uk/shop. You'll probably find that one. Just go to my website and look for it, jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And I hope it helps keep you informed and gives you the material you need to bring round all those people who are still persuaded that, oh, it's a disaster, we must amend our ways and appease the gods, appease Mother Gaia. No, we don't. It's a scam.
Now, back to the Delling Pod.
What do you do when you're younger?
From the age of 60, he probably lived as full a life as a lot of people do in their entire lives.
Yeah.
And, completely new circle of friends, new girlfriends, new social friends, new hobbies. And his lack of possessions and material wealth. He wasn't materialistic at all towards the end. I mean, for a man who had an E-type and a massive house with a swimming pool and a tennis court, you'd think that would have been a materialistic thing. But I get the feeling some of these things he just bought because of the pressure to show the trappings of the wealth that he'd never really asked for. Yeah. But he ended up in a little tiny bedsit in Barnard's Green in Malvern, across from the Morgan pub, never happier than when there. He had his complete freedom to watch the History Channel or watch your millions of podcasts, which I could never keep up with him. He'd always be up to date with your stuff. And whenever I walked with him on the hills, he'd want to talk about your latest podcast, which I hadn't got round to seeing, or a piece you'd written. Or he'd wanted to be talking about Charlie, and did you see how Charlie met the next prime minister last week? And he shows me a picture of his phone with Charlie and Rishi Sunak, and I'm rolling my eyes and I'm saying, oh God, not him. You think he'll be a prime minister, do you? Yes, this is what Charlie says. And it's like, but always wanting to know, what, living vicariously through his children, all of them.
That was the other point I tried to get across in the limited time I had available in the eulogy, which is that he could have spent the latter part of his life on a massive downer, because he started off life really from a quite prosperous background. I mean, he had his, when he was posted out to Hong Kong with the RAF, he had his car shipped out there by his dad, so he had a car to drive. His sister had her own private aeroplane and had a Ferrari Dino, she did later on in life. They weren't short of dosh. And he then had the first privately owned E-type in the country, which he bought off Tommy Sopwith, and it was Graham Hill's. It was the most famous E-type Jaguar, ECD 400, because it was the first E-type Jaguar to win a major race. And he owned it. I mean, and to have had all these things, all these wonderful toys, and then to spend your twilight years living in a one-bedroom flat, having lost all your
smelt
money.
Smelt of kippers. Love his kippers.
He could have been just ruining what might have been and feeling sorry for himself. He's never sorry for himself. He was always
to depression throughout his life, and he was always tottering on the edge of it. But I think he learned to manage it later in life, and it was partly through keeping busy and partly through having so many children and grandchildren to distract him. But yeah, that could have been the time when he sunk into what might have been and oh, poor me. But none of that. Almost like the less he had, the happier he was.
I heard something that really kind of upset me. I don't know if I should tell you this now, but so.
Well, don't. Not if it's going to upset me. I don't want to be upset.
Well, it was more. So when he lost his own business, he needed to earn a living still, because he didn't have anything to retire on. So he ended up working for somebody else in the industry, who I think probably known him when he had money, and sort of as a sort of almost a, as a favor for him, sort of semi-favor, took him on as his kind of sidekick. But they worked him like a dog. And when he was in, this would have been in his 60s, and he was having to lift up heavy crates in the warehouse, and apparently his arms became huge as a result of all. I didn't know about this stuff. And you imagine if you're used to being a company director and having your own business, and then towards the end of your working life, you are basically somebody's paid slave. He never grumbled. I just thought it was a mark of him.
I remember that time. I mean, he's effectively working for a former competitor.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I kind of knew about all that, but it was like a case of, well, you've just got to, he's just got to take it, haven't you? He needed to earn a living, and he had to do what had to be done. But, you know, he came through it, and yeah, as you say, no grumbling.
No.
Now, one of the things I felt wished we'd got in either to the main eulogy in the church or to the bit in the wake was how bloody funny he was right up to the end. His family WhatsApp comment. He's what finally killed him. We didn't realize at the time this was going to be happening. He had an obstructed bowel. So bowel movements are important at the best of times, but when you're that old, having a good one is not just desirable. It's essential. And he simply wasn't. And it's not something you necessarily want to say to your kids as they arrive to see you. How are you, Pa? Oh, I haven't had a shit in days. You know, it's not going to happen. It's not what he talked about. Well, what he did say in the family group chat, because he was already vomiting quite regularly at that point. And he says in the family group chat, "My bowels are currently like the Straits of Hormuz. Some things, like ready breck, are given free passage, but other things, like toast, are sent back the way they came." That's brilliant. He's trying to say that if I eat toast, I puke it up, but the ready breck seems to come out in the same form. I mean, it was just beautifully put, very clever, very apt, and very of its time. And I think it got us all thinking, well, he can't be that bad if he's being that funny about his bowels. But ultimately, he was describing the thing that was going to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you probably think too, what got him was a form of clot. I mean, a DVT that ended up resulting in the obstruction. Because he'd had his pacemaker fitted, and we thought, "Oh, new lease of life for power." And he thought,
and
that
it really was. He was out walking again, like it was going out of fashion.
How long did he have from the pacemaker to?
I think it was about a month,
yeah,
at least. But yeah, it's not long for that new lease of life.
I think it was what killed him, because I think that they failed to give him the blood thinners that he needed. Because there was no joined up thinking. I mean, when he was admitted to hospital, nobody was going, "Oh, did you have a pacemaker? You had surgery. Oh, it seems likely that you're having some kind of blood clotting here." Yeah. Nobody, they hadn't a clue. And you don't want to push it. You don't want to pursue them for incompetence, because actually you're quite grateful that unwittingly they gave him his wish, which was to die quickly. I mean, he was never not going to die, unfortunately, at some stage. It's just a question of how and when and how quickly.
Well, as I was sat with him for the last 3 hours, I kept on thinking, "Oh, the breathing's changed, here we go." But then I was thinking, shit, I know what's happening here. His heart's trying to give up, but the pacemaker keeps kicking back in and reviving him. And I was thinking, what a cruel twist that this thing that just gave him a new lease of life is not going to let him go quietly. And I was almost on the point of going to the nurses and saying, is there any way you can zap his pacemaker or something, you know, sort of switch him off? Because what had been happening before the pacemaker, and this was noted by his friends at the Stand in the Park group, they'd noticed that he was zoning out. Not just briefly, sort of like you and me, where, James, what are you doing? What? Sorry, what? It was like a full on, he wasn't there. The eyes were open, but he wasn't there. And this was what was the pacemaker was needed for, because according to the doctors, that's the point at which the upper chambers of the heart are working okay, but they're not communicating with the lower chambers to actually pump the blood back out. So the upper pump has happened, but the bottom pump isn't coordinated with it. And what the pacemaker does is gives it a jolt and a shock to make it coordinate again. So it's not restarting a failed heart, it's just getting it back to coordination. And then it would be like, oh, so he never had any more of those events, but he was saying that he could feel when the pacemaker was kicking in. He could feel this thing sort of suddenly perking him up again, when he would previously have been drifting off. Now I'm thinking, as he went, he might have wanted to be drifting off into So... I wonder about that pacemaker.
Right. I'm thinking I don't want a pacemaker. I quite like the idea of just sort of zoning out for periods. I mean, it's what I do anyway.
Well, it has to be said, even though he was fit for his age, we are considerably fitter at our age than he was.
Yes.
You know, our diet and our exercise regime is way, way better than his ever was. So for a man of his generation, it's amazing that he did live to 91. But I think if we continue as we do, looking after ourselves and eating well and staying off to a large degree the things that aren't good for us, then we should do all right.
It swings and roundabouts, though, isn't it? Because his generation didn't have the vaccination schedule that our generation had. Mm-hmm. And we in turn have benefited from not having nearly as extreme a vaccination schedule as children being born today have.
Yeah. Yeah, that is tragic. The more we know about our health, the more we're being poisoned.
Yeah. He did try playing catch up as best he could. He was very anti-pharma towards the end, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Especially when his doctor gave him something which he was hallucinating.
Yeah.
And you looked at the side effects of this whatever stupid big pharma drug it was, and you saw, hallucinations.
did he leave those behind? Because that sounds quite interesting.
He wasn't very positive about them. He wasn't recommending them particularly.
No, I don't think it was nice hallucinations.
If any interesting drugs will have been reclaimed by one of our other siblings.
Sure. I did actually have a carrier bag full of his various prescription drugs, and they've all been returned to a pharmacy, which is what you're supposed to do with them. Just for once, what? I did the right thing. Oh, come
what
on.
What about the bagloads? Mazepam and stuff?
That got shifted sideways.
I was going to say, yeah, thank you.
Most of it was out of date. But,
but I mean, it's out of date. Tamazepam is better than...
is this a famous saying?
I'm sure it is.
Yeah. Out of date tamazepam is better than no tamazepam.
Dope gets you through times of no money better than money gets you through times of no dope. It's another of those those phrases.
Only users lose drugs. Hmm. And such things. Yeah. I don't think anything that he's left behind has particularly gone to waste. We're still clearing his tiny apartment. And I just think in the slideshow we gave, we had a picture of the old rectory, which was a very important house in our childhood. It was when Dellingpole Family Mark II kicked in and he had to accommodate two new stepsisters, and a new half-brother and a new half-sister, and three kids from the original marriage, all in one massive, beautiful old house. And I showed a picture of it, and there were apparently audible gasps as to the scale of the house we once lived in. Because a lot of people have only known him for his tiny little apartment.
We think of ourselves as ordinary, don't we?
Yeah, we do, but we've got nothing to measure it by particularly, have we?
No.
I'm just so grateful that we haven't got to clear out something the size of the old rectory. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Oh, I just...
I mean, if he'd hung around in that house... You know, because it was easier than moving. And I know a lot of the generation, our generation's parents are currently doing that. You know, people visit their parents in their childhood home and half a dozen rooms are staying empty. But you've still got to clear that entire thing and all the sentimental bits and pieces, some of which might have financial value, but you've still got to sell them. I mean, we've got, what have we got? About two or three pieces of Staffordshire, a couple of average paintings, and not much else. And I couldn't even be asked to sell the Staffordshire. You know, it's going to be a right pain to take that to an antiques dealer or get it valued someone who... I'm just thinking that the scale of the issue would be vastly greater if we took on a bigger house. And I'm very grateful of the scale of what you mentioned it in the show, didn't you? You said to all old people here, if you want your siblings to stay happy, your kids to stay not falling out with each other after your death, don't leave them anything. Because we've got pretty much nothing coming to us and we're all getting on great. In fact, the only discussion has been, well, I don't particularly want that. I've got nowhere to put that armchair or that painting. Do you want it? And it's been a case of doing right by him, but no one is saying, well, I want that. I definitely want that. Actually, having said that, I did take his prepper generator. He's got a solar-powered electric generator that's ideal for the post-apocalyptic scenario. Because obviously you'll want to charge your mobile phone when the zombie apocalypse hits, when there's no network and it wouldn't you be any use anyway.
I did get a twinge of envy when you managed to snaffle that one.
Yeah. That's all I was asking. That was my... That's my legacy, that is.
Yeah.
But really, how useful will it be in the post-apocalyptic scenario?
I should have asked you earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Are unregistered trick chickens free on August the 1st?
I will have to look in my diary. August the 1st sounds like... Yeah, I'll have to look it up.
Because I was hoping to have my next event, my birthday bash. Then
it's always good that you do so much forward planning for these things. It's great.
I know, this is the problem.
You need an expert funeral organizer to get on the case.
Yeah. Because had you definitely been available, I could have announced it and announced the guest. Guest.
No,
special
wow.
guest.
So a special guest.
Special guest, yeah.
So it's not me.
It may be you if he pulls out.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, one thing we should definitely do before we wrap this up is quash any rumors that a certain cartoonist was at our father's funeral, because I don't believe that was the case, but there have been rumours that he was there.
I was wondering whether or not you were going to mention that, because I have to say, we are living in such weird times at the moment. I find it mystifying, depressing, mind-blowingly weird that the way that it seems to have developed into the terror stage of the French Revolution or the terror stage of Stalin, well, or the Bolshevik Revolution when they start executing all the kulaks, or when they form these revolutionary committees to test how pure you are. And I mean, you and I started out in this game because, well, we wanted to entertain people and ask questions, and I mean, I already had a track record of a career in journalism. I'm a good writer. That was how I became I got to be a top journalist, and all I did was carry on these things into this new world where I realized that the whole world, everything we'd been taught about the world, was a lie. And so I had this new world to, I lost all my old audience and gained a new audience, and I don't grumble about I don't make a big deal about the fact that I've lost my career. I'm really happy with where I am now. But what I do object to is being put before these sort of truth committees, purity committees, where I get judged on who I associate with and stuff. And it's got to the point where if it's discovered that a certain cartoonist came to your father's he didn't reject the cartoonist when the cartoonist was asked questions and didn't answer them and thus proved himself unsatisfactory to the committee, therefore by association, by talking to this prescribed figure, you too are guilty. It's weird, isn't it? Say to your friends,
tie yourself up into knots with this sort of thing.
I can't talk to you anymore. But why not? Well, I really like you, but you know, it could damage my. I could get locked up. I could get my career ended. I could get. I wish we could all I wish we could all be friends and stop. I think we've got bigger battles to fight.
Yeah, certainly have. But I thought I had to drop that in because had a lovely pint yesterday. The evening of the funeral at my favouritest pub, the Nag's Head.
So I envied you greatly, Dick. Had the after show and I didn't. I was coming down from the rave and I really wanted to go.
Yeah. You had other duties and it's not your fault. And I'm sure you were there in spirit, but it was very pleasant and it was nice to have the full wind down. It was the chill out room at the end of the rave.
That's it. Yeah.
So it was nice to have that. And to the Fawn Cafe the following morning, the very same table where all five of us siblings met post mortem. So it was almost like the full circle. It was lovely.
Which I was very happy with. Morven looked after us very well. I thought Gary, the vicar at Christchurch, did
yep.
it, and his musical director. They did a fantastic job.
Like at Christchurch, which was some of our listeners may know it as the big church next to what was until very recently Malvern Girls College.
And is now a Chinese spy centre.
if it wasn't already.
If it wasn't already. And then we had the Abbey Hotel, which for a sort of fading Victorian hotel in a spa town, I mean, they're all past
they're past peak hotel period,
past peak hotel. I thought they did a really good job. The sandwiches were good. I was not disappointed. I thought
you've got high sandwich standards as well, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, obviously they didn't do any foie gras sandwiches with.
I didn't go for the foie gras option.
Oh, that's why we didn't get them.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. But the bread was fresh, and the fillings were good, and it was. I wasn't
cakes were nice.
What is that?
Yeah, and it was air conditioned to the point of perfection. It was just like it was bliss walking in there, and obviously that was not something I thought to check a month ago when I was booking the place. Is it air conditioned? Because 99.9% of the time in this country, you don't necessarily need air conditioning. But boy, were we glad it was there that day, because a lot of his contemporaries were there who were in their 90s themselves. They would have just melted. They would have not hung around and been able to enjoy the full Dick and James show, which they were able to do so. And I'm thinking particularly of our Auntie Sheila, who was able to stay for the whole thing when she'd been threatening to leave because, you know, she's very tired these days and doesn't get around as easily as she could. But she was there, able to quote Parr's service number when he was in the RAF, and she remembers it verbatim and is able to read it out. Because he used to write to her while she was at St. James's school in Malvern. So many Malvern links, so many connections to Malvern.
There's almost a pun there, didn't
you? Yeah.
Yeah, but Malvern you didn't labour it.
No.
It was very nice seeing some old friends that we hadn't seen for a very long, well, since childhood, pretty much.
Mm.
One of our childhood friends became a racing driver.
Touring car champion. He won the championship. Matt Neal, first privateer to win the touring car championship, which is...
Imagine
quite an achievement.
Parr would have been quite impressed if one of us had done that, wouldn't he?
I think he'd love to... The aforementioned cartoonist wanted to know why, with such petrol-headed heritage, none of us are particularly interested in cars. Not one of the five of us has particularly taken on a love of engines, motors, and what have you. We've had our motorbikes and we've had our cars, yeah, but never to the extent of knowing what we were doing under the bonnet.
And are you going to explain why? I've got a theory.
Go on.
Well, because we spent our lives frustrating Parr's expectations for us.
Of course we didn't do it, because that's what was expected of
exactly.
us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was fighting this battle to push us in a particular direction, knowing that we were always going to ignore him. Yeah. And so it gave him great pleasure that we ignored all his advice, but it didn't mean he stopped trying to push us in. Yeah. He wanted me to be an entrepreneur.
Hmm.
Really, by the time I was going into journalism, he was still, you should really go out to China or wherever, go out to Singapore, I think that was the thing at the time. Go out to Singapore and be an entrepreneur and blah, blah, blah.
Start an import company. He's probably right. We'd
have been
because
rich.
It was a time when his own business were nuts and bolts. Manufacturing in this country was dying, and he realized it was because they were making it cheaper in the Far East, which is the story of everything, all manufacture in Europe. So if you had been the man to start cashing in on the fact that the manufacturing had shifted out east, then, yeah, you'd have been rolling in it. But it's completely not in line with your personality. You'd have been probably rubbish at it as well. You're not organized enough.
I think... it's too hot for me to have to record an extra video about why my live events are really good and why my birthday bash, whenever it is, is going to be really good. Dick, explain to people why the, like, you can't.
Well, because it's a bit like Third Wednesday. Meeting IRL is not just twice as good as meeting online. It's probably 10 times better. So, imagine a podcast, but it's 10 times better because you are living the podcast and meeting all the people taking part and the audience.
In a nice, in a really nice country setting. I'm thinking of making it a sort of all-dayer this time, and maybe having the podcast bit a sort of in the middle, so that people can go home if they want to. So obviously the drinking crowd can stay for the after show,
it's almost like a Delling Pod followed by a Third Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a nice idea.
I'm glad you're the marketing man. I hadn't thought about that.
Mm.
So I think the only thing that stands in a way of its success is my organizational abilities in that I'm leaving it quite late. But I think if people are around in August, they should be.
You've winged it successfully before, so let's see how it goes. I will have to check out the chicken's very busy, full schedule. But actually, it's more likely to be whether or not I'm doing things, because I do have commitments. My wife is walking down the garden towards my shed. I think I'm going to be called away for something. And it's her birthday today. So do you want to be in the podcast? No.
Oh, happy birthday, Lid.
He says happy birthday. Thank
just,
you.
Just come and just make her just like...
You want to just walk
just
by?
Poke your, just like...
No. Come on. Well, you know she wouldn't. Yeah. She has nothing. It would be... The idea is horrifying to her. Okay. Anyway, let's call it a day.
Yeah.
And I better go and do wifey things, as it is her birthday.
And you probably get on to do wifey things. They're so demanding.
Yeah.
I've got to go and do wife pleasing things now as well.
Well, do you know what I was doing at 8:30 this morning after my swim?
Hang on, let me just guess. You were scraping poo off the chickens.
No, I would rather have been doing that. I was waiting for T.G. Jones, a.k.a. W.H. Smith, to open so I could go and buy her a bloody birthday card, which I completely failed to do because of what I've been dealing with for the last week.
And they have the temerity to blame you like it's your fault, or like you should have thought of it earlier.
And you know what? She must have spent one-tenth as long looking at it as I spent choosing it. It's a bit like a meal that you've spent 2 hours cooking and then 15 minutes eating.
Yeah.
I hate cards.
Oh, I hate cards even more than you do. Seriously, I do.
One could hate cards more than I hate cards.
You try buying cards in Daventry, I tell you. You cannot buy. We have to think so far, like for you, for example, we have to think a year in advance and when we're going to a shop where there's a card with a badger on it.
You buy when you find rather than when you need to. Yeah. That's the only way. I've just lost you visuals-wise.
Yeah, I know. Something weird's happened.
Okay, let's let it do its thing and I'll say bye-bye to our lovely audience.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Stop. Stop. There is now a new, better way of supporting me. If you want to, you can now subscribe direct at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. It's now got new features where you can subscribe directly to me. You get access to all my old archive material. You get my podcasts as they come out. And you can comment on the podcast and you can communicate with me probably more directly than you can elsewhere. I think it's probably the best way forward. Also, it obviates the risk of my being suddenly randomly closed down by some of these other websites. I mean, they're not our friends. So if you want to support me direct, go to jamesdellingpole.co.uk and sign up there. Without your support, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So thank you.
Support ridiculously honest, no holds barred, independent truth seeking at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. The Delling Pod is produced by Wolfish Limited. Guests are very kindly booked by the lovely Venetia. The show is edited by Andrew Warwick, with animation by Warwick A.